gmail.com. I have a very special guest today, Dr. E. Michael Jones. He's the editor of Culture Wars magazine and the author of numerous books. He's a very well-known Catholic author. He's got a PhD in English Lit, and he joins me today. Thank you so much, Dr. Jones.
You're welcome.
So I'll start out with a quote from the Bible, a quote you're familiar with. I want to get your exegesis on this. I'll say it in Greek. En arche en halogos, kai halogos en prostantheon, kai theos en halogos. In English, that is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Can you talk about that verse specifically about the Logos?
Yeah, that's the first three sentences from the prologue of the Gospel of St. John. And it is in many ways the turning point in human history. Up until St. John wrote his Gospel in Greek, that you read it in the original Greek. This incorporated into it all of Greek philosophy, including and especially the term logos, which is something we don't know if all we're familiar with is the English translation. The English translation is, in the beginning there was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The word Word, the English word Word, simply does not convey the meaning of the Greek word logos, because logos has was embedded in Greek philosophy, and it had five pages of meanings in the Liddell Scott dictionary for one English word. So in order to understand what's going on here, you have to first understand that this concept is central to the whole idea of Greek philosophy. What is Greek philosophy? It's the love of wisdom. At a certain point, let's go all the way at the beginning. Let's go to the beginning. The first man, this man is now created by God. He lives in paradise. He loses paradise. And at this point, he and his offspring are now have to struggle to regain what they lost. There's never been a time when human beings did not have a concept of some ultimate reality. The general word they used for that ultimate reality was God. Every culture, no matter how primitive, has certain things in common. There is no human culture without language. There is no culture that doesn't live together with other human beings and use language as the medium of communication. And one of the main concepts in any language, any primitive language, is the word for God. We find that the word God is associated with the Father. This is before Revelation, and the Father lives in the sky. It's associated with the sky. At this point, a man, again, as I said, trying to regain some sense of what he knew inchoately before, starts talking about God. What can we know about God? What can we know about the ultimate reality? Well, if God is a father, God must have a beard. And at this point, man starts marching down the blind alley that came to be known as mythology. He's trying to come to some understanding of ultimate reality, but he's incapable of any sense of abstraction. And so he just starts thinking in picture terms, and he bases his understanding on pictures that he makes in his mind, his imagination, his fantasy. And as a result, you end up with things like Homer's Iliad, where basically you have men fighting in front of Troy, and gods are pretty much a little bit a higher level, but pretty much involved in the same type of thing. They get jealous of each other, they get angry. They're like Achilles. They're like an exalted form of Achilles. At a certain point, the Greeks got dissatisfied with this idea. It wasn't going anywhere. We're getting more and more elaborate stories that were leading you farther and farther away from any real understanding of what God was. And at a certain point, they decided there was a break. It was made. And the break began with a group of physicists Fusikoi is what they were called, Thales of Miletus in Ionia, which is on the western shore of what is now Turkey, the eastern shore of the Aegean, decided to look at the world, and they say, well, it must be made up of something. Let's just talk about what these things are as trying to figure out the ultimate reality of the world that we know. And Thales said it was water, and then Anaxagoras said it was air, and Heraclitus said it was fire. But all these people had some type of sense of abstraction, but not enough abstraction. And finally, Heraclitus, around this time, so we're talking now, we're going from the 8th to maybe the 4th, beginning of the 5th century BC, starts talking about Logos. And Logos and fire are in many ways related. Some people say that Heraclitus was living in the Persian Empire. Some people say he got this idea from the Zoroastrians who worship fire. Fire is always in motion, and yet it's always the same if you think about a candle flame. And so maybe this is what Logos is like. Maybe it's the explanation of the form of that fire. And at that point, we reached humanity had reached a level of abstraction that he'd never reached before. The only other group of people that were comparable in this regard were the Hebrews, and they have a language that is notorious for its lack of abstraction. Everything is very concrete in Hebrew. You know, God is a rock, and we go on and on. It could go on and on and on. And the Greeks had the sense of abstraction, and they came to this idea that maybe it was something that wasn't, you couldn't even draw a picture of it. So we're way beyond what God, you know, the ultimate reality is God, but he's got a beard. We're way beyond that now. We're in something that it's so abstract you can't draw a picture of it. You can only use, it's a concept, and we have a word for the concept, and that's all we have. And at that point, it was developed, Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle said that God was the unmoved mover and the uncaused cause, which is a very abstract understanding of God as the end of it. No infinite regress here, something that had to be the end point. And Plato decided that it was he lived in eternity, but did he care for us? And Plato said he was the demiurge, which cared for us. And they reached an impasse because the uncaused cause is obviously eternal, but how can it function in the world? And the demiurge can function in the world, but how can it be eternal? And so you're in a bind, and that was the end of philosophy, pretty much. Mm. And 400 years later, St. John comes along, and he takes that whole Greek concept of Logos, and he moves it forward in a totally unexpected way, because the arrival of Jesus Christ on this earth, that's what he's talking about when he says Logos is God. This is the Logos incarnate. It's totally different than anything we've ever talked about before, because it's not simply the history of philosophy anymore. It's a person. That's what he said. Logos is God. That's a person. And this person has entered history. And as a result, history has completely changed. Everything has changed. And it took basically everyone about 1,000 years to digest that simple fact, probably 1,300 years. That's what Logos is. That's why what you read is the turning point in history, because up until the time of Plato, and I'm talking about people like St. Augustine, who lived 300 years after Christ, 400 years after Christ, still tried to be a Platonist in his younger days. And by that, he was going to contemplate eternal things and rise above mundane cares. It was called otium liberale, leisure, free leisure. And he had to realize that project it's obsolete. We don't need this project anymore because the Logos has descended. We don't have to ascend. The Logos has descended. And now we have a new, deeper understanding. Okay, and what you're talking about here also, those three sentences, are also the beginning of our understanding of the Trinity. Because Logos is God, but he's with God. And that doesn't make sense unless you start thinking in line with the Trinity. And at this point, mankind is faced with a choice. To this day, either you accept this new knowledge on God's terms, which means you could never have come up with it yourself, which means you're kind of dependent and it's not an internally created project. Either you accept it on God's terms or you get left behind by the course of history. Well, and that's pretty much what happened.
Well, yeah, because you talked about how you started to first think of Logos, and like you kind of embarked on this project of discovering Logos back in 2003. You've talked about how the Cold War had been over. Then all of a sudden, before we know it, we're going to war again. I mean, the States. I'm from Canada, so I suppose we didn't go there. But like the people who were moving for the war, exactly how did you take this and come up with the idea of Logos? You see chaos here, and how does that move you in the direction of this truth?
Well, first of all, yeah, we go back to 2003, and suddenly I realize, a lot of us realize, that our entire foreign policy has been hijacked by a very small but definite group of people. They were called neoconservatives. Everybody knew this was a Jewish movement, but nobody could articulate that. First of all, because you're not allowed to say that there are such things as Jewish movements. But secondly, because no one could place this on a proper perspective. Nobody could get a handle on it. What does that mean to say it's a Jewish movement? And you had someone like Irving Kristol, he's the father of neoconservatism. He's called a conservative. But in his youth, he followed Trotsky. So he was a communist, a Bolshevik. So how do you reconcile these things? Well, I said at that point, I started to realize when I embarked upon this project that it's impossible to reconcile, to come to understanding of the causality of the war in Iraq if all you're dealing with is political categories. We're dealing with something deeper here. We're dealing with a Jewish political movement. And in order to understand that, we have to define what a Jew is. And at this point, you get into trouble with a lot of people because the Jews don't want to be defined. They like to use the ambiguity to their advantage. So what is a Jew? Well, is it racial? And the conclusion I came to was no, it's not racial. It has nothing. There are racist elements within Judaism, among the Jews. But what we're talking about here goes back to, again, the starting point you mentioned, the Gospel of St. John. So in addition to having a metaphysical explanation of the beginning of everything, it also has a good description of the conflict between Jesus Christ and the Jews in his time, which was basically that the Jews wanted the Messiah on their term. And Jesus better get with the plan. And I'm talking about the seventh chapter of the Gospel of St. John, where they say to Jesus, we're the seed of Abraham. So we're special, and we have special DNA, and your plan better conform to that, our special DNA. And Jesus Christ laughs at them and says, you know, God doesn't need your DNA. God can raise up stones if he wanted to, could create men out of stones. And they say, well, we're the children of Moses. And Jesus says, no, you're not the children of Moses. Because Moses was longing for this day, and if you reject me, you reject Moses. So who are they? Who are they? What is the definition of this group? It's not biological, because you have passages in the same gospel where Jesus says, or talks about the parents of the man born blind. The parents of the man born blind refuse to speak out of fear of the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the Jews would expel from the synagogue anyone who said that Jesus was the Messiah. Well, they all have the same DNA if you're talking about biology.
Yeah, so and like Jesus and the apostles and the Blessed Mother and St. Paul and like the whole early church had that DNA.
Right, so it can't be racial. So what's the distinction? Well, it comes down to Logos again. And this is how I got started on the project that I'm doing now back in 2003. The only coherent explanation is that a Jew is a rejecter of Logos. Jesus Christ is the Logos incarnate. When he arrived, the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ became known as Christians, and they've been members of the Catholic Church. The Jews who rejected him are known as Jews to this day. And so there's no straight course in history here if you're using the word Jew, because the children of Moses find their fulfillment in Jesus Christ and the Catholic Church. And that is the straight line of history. So when you reject Logos, as I said, you go back to Liddell Scott's dictionary, you reject a lot of stuff. You reject the order of the universe. And when you reject the order of the universe, you become a revolutionary. And that's what the Jews have been for 2,000 years. And that is the thesis. I just gave you the thesis of the book you're holding up, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit.
By the way, I fully recommend this book to everyone watching this interview. It's a long book. Take a look. But no, it is worth every penny you'll spend on it. You can go buy it at Dr. Jones' site, culturewars.com. I think that's your site, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so tell us a bit more about the Jewish revolutionary spirit then.
Well, the Jews rejected Jesus Christ. They called for his death and they chose Barabbas, who was a revolutionary. And it's always good to be careful what you pray for, because they got what they prayed for. They got their revolutionary leader. In 70 AD, the Jews rose up in rebellion against the Roman Empire, and they were crushed, and the temple was destroyed. This is the end of Judaism, okay, as a historical phenomenon. The Jews no longer had, they didn't have a temple, they didn't have a priesthood, and they didn't have sacrifice. The rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realized which way the wind was blowing. He got smuggled out in a shroud, and he asked Titus for the permission to start a school, and that is the beginning of what we now call Judaism. So mm-hmm. Judaism, the Judaism of the synagogue is what we're talking about. The Judaism of the Talmud is younger than Christianity.
Yeah, and
the Jews.
I'm just curious. I'm sorry to cut you off. Have you heard of this book? It's called Why the Jews, The Reason for Antisemitism, co-authored by Dennis Prager and Joseph Telushkin?
No.
Okay, it came out in 2003, so back when you're starting this, and I found this amazing quote. I want to show you this quote. It is fascinating. The association of Jews with revolutionary doctrines and social upheaval has not, unfortunately, been the product of anti-Semites' imaginations. Marx, Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, Luxembourg, Kuhn, Rudd, Hoffman, Rubin, Kunstler, Finkelstein and Chomsky are among the better known. So I was just reading this the other day, and it was, it's a glaring admission. And of course, they can say it, you know, because they're Jewish. But if you say it, you got a 3-page ad on the Anti-Defamation League website.
Right. That is the reason. That's how I landed on the ADL's Anti-Defamation League website, because I wrote that book. And as you point out right there, I'm not saying anything that Jews have not already said. Most of the book is simply quotes from Jews explaining the situation as it proceeded throughout history. One of the main sources for the book was Heinrich Graetz, who's the father of Jewish historiography. Heinrich Graetz said that the Polish Jews were morally corrupted by studying the Talmud. Because it taught them how to cheat and steal. So right now we are confronting the main paradox or contradiction of our age. In other words, the Jew can say exactly the same thing that I am saying. He will be praised for his candor and his honesty, and I will be condemned as an anti-Semite for making exactly the same statement.
Yeah, and... Yeah, and you talk about that quote from Tikkun Olam magazine with right. Amy Dean. Just talk about that quote for a second.
Well, she said that if it weren't for the Jews, we wouldn't have gay marriage.
Yeah, and of
Joe
course.
Biden said the same thing. He's not a Jew, but he said it. And as long as you say it with praise in your tone of voice, everything's okay. As soon as you say, well, wait a minute, I don't think gay marriage is a good thing at all. I think it's undermining marriage. I think it's completely consistent with the thesis of the Jewish revolutionary spirit. This is one more attempt to overthrow the social and moral order of our country. At that point, you're called an anti-Semite.
So I got a question. I know the vast majority of Jews will just say, oh, Jones is an anti-Semite, and he wrote that book. He writes all these articles against us. But there are thoughtful Jews out there. Have some Jews attempted to actually give an honest critique of the book? Like, sit down, try to tackle the thesis?
There are. I had an honest dialogue with Chuck Morse. I had an honest dialogue with Rabbi Lightman on an Israeli show.
The Kabbalist from Israel, right?
Right. I think we had a sort of a meeting of the minds there. But for the most part, the Jews do not want to talk with you. Or when they do talk to you, it turns out to be like Michael Brown, who all he's trying to do is twist my words. It was like right out of the New Testament, Jesus talking to the Pharisees. That's what it's like talking to Michael Brown.
Yeah, he tried to change the translation of a word. Oh no, it should say this. When he knows what the Greek says,
Greek. He takes things out of context. He can't allow me to say what I want to say, what I'm trying to say to you, because if he does, he loses the argument. So he's got to twist it into something that I do not say, which he does all the time.
And a thing that's interesting about Brown, I've actually got about 10 of his books because I'm an apologist, and so he's written like a multi-volume series of arguments responding to Judaism, and he is so clever in that. The arguments he gives from his biblical scholarship are so clever, but as soon as it comes to something like this that we're talking about, it's like his IQ is cut in half almost.
Because you have an outcome that you want to achieve, and you're going to do whatever it takes to basically cram what I have to say into the pigeonhole you've created, which is anti-Semitism. So it comes down to basically, what is the definition of anti-Semitism? It used to be, people who didn't like Jews, and then it became anyone who criticized the Jew, and now it's anyone who disagrees with the Jew is an anti-Semite. You have to accept their narrative. You have to accept their interpretation, even of your own scriptures. And if you do not do that, then you will be called an anti-Semite.
Well, and the thing that's so problematic about that definition, like you've talked about before, how the definition goes back to the 19th century and it's a purely racial term. It was used by racists against the Jews, and people knew exactly what it was. But now there's this new radical definition that, like for example, there's this author I like. Have you heard of this author?
Who is that?
It's Ilan Pape.
No.
Okay, no. He's an Israeli historian, but he's very anti-Israel. He accuses them of ethnic cleansing. This book's called The Biggest Prison on Earth. It's about the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And, of course, he's called an anti-Semite, and he's Israeli Jewish, you know. It's getting ridiculous because it's a fake definition, so it can't apply. The the true definition makes sense, but you got the IHRA definition, which is pretty much anyone you want's an anti-Semite. I actually, each time someone calls me an anti-Semite, I call them an anti-Semite. I just call back because that term has no meaning, and I like to show them that. You talked about...